and welcome to Tabletop Game Talk On Topic, a show where we talk about tabletop gaming topics of all kinds. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Kitty.
And I'm Chris.
Today we're looking at your feedback on cheating, managing your collection, and complicated games. Chris wanted to name this episode, It's Complicated Managing Your Cheating Collection, but phone screens aren't that big yet, so he'll have to shorten it. But in order to name the episode, we have to finish it. So let's get started.
But first, as always, a thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, Emil Jiljam, George Gia, Adam Harrison, Corey Bell, and the SGC. And a huge thank you to all our other patrons as well. And for the record, phone screens are almost getting big enough.
Almost. I mean, I guess it depends on what kind of phone you have.
I know, the iPhone SX Max or whatever the heck that is. I think it could possibly do it. Whew. Okay, we have a lot of feedback here. I think our Managing Your Collection episode got the most likes of anything, like the last five episodes combined. And we got like 150 pieces of feedback for it. So we're going to read every single one of them verbatim.
Oh, yeah.
That's a lie.
It's definitely a lie. But it does remind me, we get a lot of feedback. So if we're reading your feedback, we're probably paraphrasing it greatly. And if we didn't read your feedback, it's only because we're not reading on air. We read everything. And yes, I promise it's not a waste of your time. We love hearing from you. So, Kitty, why don't you kick us off?
All right. Michael wrote in about alpha players versus AP players. It seems to me the ultimate game goal of a game is recreation. Players should enjoy themselves. However, some find enjoyment primarily in performing well. Alpha players are like that. Their enjoyment is in playing well and making the best decisions. That is also what AP players equate to enjoying the game. Alpha playing is the AP of co-op games. It is performance-focused and driven, and so it is perfectly acceptable to others who also think the way to have fun, but not to the majority of players.
Yeah, that totally resonates with me. I mean, as soon as he brought up the AP thing, I was like, yes. Like, I remember us having that conversation in that episode where I talked about my AP. And, you know, that was the enjoyment for me in the game is I love, you know, going through every different move that can be made and making sure I'm picking the optimal one. And so I totally resonate with this, Michael. So, yeah, spot on for me as the AP player.
The only thing I think is a little bit different is the AP player often is willing to kind of collaborate with a team on what the optimal move is, whereas the, at least the problem alpha player is the, no, I know the best way. And that's right. Where the big difference is.
My favorite part is they're both AP. So alpha player or analysis paralysis. In gaming, we've decided that AP are just a bad couple of letters to put together.
Terrible letters.
Ah, I love both alpha players and AP players since I'm married to one and one of my best friends is another one. So I have no bias whatsoever. But I do think this is a good way of pointing this out. The whole alpha player is the analysis paralysis player of the co-op genre. I love it.
And he's also not quite admitting that he is a bit of an alpha player now and then himself, aren't you, Chris?
I just think that we should play optimally for my fun.
Fair enough. So anyway, next one is from Robert, who also comments on alpha players. He says, I wanted to say was that all alpha players are not bad or mean. That not all alpha players are not bad or mean. The alpha player that gets me irritated is the one that tells you how to play and won't let you make a decision by yourself. There's no discussion or banter. It's that alpha player's way or the highway. It's one of the reasons I don't play co-op games with people I don't know.
So I typically don't like playing games with people I don't know because I don't know what kind of player they're going to be for the same reason. I think in a co-op game, though, I would actually be okay if it, if I'm like random stranger, we're playing and that person just wants to play the whole game. I'd be like, all right, well, at least I don't have to pay too close of attention. I can just let them play. And if they're happy, I'm happy.
I think it can also be tricky, though, if you're playing with a new player who doesn't want to make any decisions at all.
Yes.
Co-op games are much harder to walk into blind. You want to know the group before you play, much more so than in a competitive game.
Yeah, and I will say, if there are certain games, I will not have my non-gaming friends or like friends that are like more gaming curious, I guess that's a term. Like I won't bring them into a co-op game with Sydney and I. because I know that Sydney and I are going to be very much like when we play, we are both alphas and we balance each other out. But if we have a third player
pushy.
In there, yes, no, not
pushy.
Pushy against each other though means teamwork.
It's true.
But if I'm going to play with somebody who's not used to that level of debate, then I'm like, let's pick a different game where we're not just going to steamroll them, because we know that no matter how hard we try, we're probably going to do that anyway.
It feels like mom and dad are fighting.
Yes. Sorry, Jen. All right. David gave me, actually all of us, a little bit of a lecture yeah. on Dominion. So David says Dominion needs some love. It needs a lot of love. And he gave me four paragraphs of reasons why. I'm going to try to trim this down a little bit. He's like, on BGG, there are only a couple games with the deck building, pool building mechanic that are above Dominion. And none of those have playtimes less than an hour. That isn't to say that it's for everyone. His theme is a bit dry, and fully appreciate you need one or more expansions to, you know, give it some more playthroughs. However, now is a really great time to get into Dominion because they have a second edition out. They have a couple of the early expansions are in second edition. There's a new expansion coming out now. He does mention that some of the more recent expansions are a little bit more complicated, which kind of fits in with everything else we've been talking about. And for people who've been playing it a long time, that's good. But the most recent expansion is pretty streamlined. David, yeah. First of all, this came from a comment from Kitty. So Kitty, what do you have to say about this?
I am going to play dumb. I don't remember saying it. I'm sorry. I don't know.
It was 3 weeks ago. But I think it is one of those things where we tend to use Dominion as that game that has an infinite number of expansions when it's really infinity minus four. And it
can be a bit of a punching bag. It's a go-to make fun of game.
Yeah.
It's up there with Munchkin and apples to apples with our let's make fun of games.
Especially since neither of you guys have played this. But I should fix it. We have played deck building games though.
Yes. And I think my point in the episode, and I'm going to give myself favorable memory here, was that it has this reputation in the community, not that I think that about it, because I can't make that statement because I've never played it.
But your observation that they are, I think the last Gen Con, there's like, I'm pretty sure it's literally 10 expansions that they were selling for half price. And I think that's really what you were looking at as far as like, well, you could pick up Dominion for practically nothing because they want to give that game away. So
it's true.
I do love Dominion. I'll play Dominion anytime someone wants to set it up. For me, the problem with Dominion is there's too much of it now. Every expansion introduces a little bit more. Mixing expansions is tricky. You can't just put all the cards together because you're not going to get a satisfying game. But any one expansion plus the base, or even two expansions plus the base, can be really, really fun games. It does play really quickly once you get into it. Like by the time you're done drawing and organizing your hand, it's your turn again. Once you have like four people that are really into it. I do like Dominion, and I'm sorry that we make it seem like we don't. It's not a bad game. It's not a bad game at all. Sorry, David. All right.
So the next one is from Eric, who says, I doubt I'd game with someone who has issues purposely cheating for very long. Now that I have kids, though, I do find myself cheating for them a bit, especially when they are very young. That is probably a separate topic in itself, but you can only beat my middle child so many times in a row before she comes very salty.
As a salty middle child myself, I know this feeling, and I think it's very tricky for parents to game with their kids. And as an educator, I don't cheat for the kid. I like to point out moves that are good for them, like teach the game as we play each time so that they can get on an equal footing. And if they are losing just from luck, you know, that's a skill you have to learn, is how to lose graciously. But it's a tricky one. And I think that playing with kids is going to be a future topic pretty soon here.
Yeah, now that
we're going to make you guys all play with some kids.
I do enjoy playing games with kids, but you do kind of play differently. Like, it depends on what you're trying to learn. Like, I know when I, you know, play with my parents or something, my dad would never let me win. So it's like, it's one of those things. You grow up and it's like, yep, dad's always going to win. And the first time you beat him, it's like, oh my God, that's like, I've grown up. I've come of age. But I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing to encourage people to get better and actually enjoy the game. It's just kind of, I don't know. It's a tricky line.
I think that's why most kids' games are luck-based, because they have an equal chance of winning as everyone else at the table. You don't have to be as skilled. And as you grow into, games are fun for that reason, then you can add more and more skill elements that they can get better and better at actually winning, actually playing the game.
This is very true.
All right. So if it's not obvious, we're talking about cheating now. Kitty, you take the next one.
All right. Well, it's still Eric. Eric continues.
Oh.
Video games, though. That's a different story. Back when I actually played video games, I'd check out the cheats the moment I got bored with one. Sometimes messing with the game was more fun than playing it. It's a different story if you are cheating and it affects other players, as that can really ruin a game, and it isn't something we've ever messed with.
Yeah, I completely agree with the video game comment. It's just, I remember when I was young, I think I mentioned this in the episode, that, you know, there was a hotline you could ring, and I'd run up like a massive phone bill finding out the cheats on this hotline, and someone would literally talk you through the cheat. But on a side note, earlier he mentions that his middle child was very salty. I love that term. That's such an American term. I didn't even hear that before I came here. And now my niece is constantly doing it. And she's definitely one who, you know, you can't really, she's 13. Well, it's Gloria's niece, really, but, you know, we're all family. And she doesn't like to lose. But the thing is, and I would normally let her win, but she's at that age where she can tell when I'm pulling punches. So I'm just like, I can't, because she'll be angry at the fact that I'm pulling punches if I let her win. So there's a real catch-22 there.
Yeah. Well, she's smart enough now to realize when you didn't make an optimal move. So if you can't justify what you did, then she's going to call you on it. It's like, why did you do that? You should have done this over here. So it's kind of like she's helping, but more or less she's basically pointing out how not smart you are.
Yeah, she's like, don't let me win. God.
Yeah. And now I would want to say, in video games, the difference between like modifying something locally versus modifying something to do better against other people is sort of the difference between like modding versus cheating. And I think in board games, we have kind of a similar thing where we have like variant rules, or, you know, it's like, well, let's play it this way. Or, you know, Monopoly is a great one for that. We all cheat at Monopoly because none of us play by the rules, but it's what we all agree to. So that's more of a mod than it is a cheat. So.
Absolutely.
All right.
So next one is from Michael. He says, I love the discussion about the spirit of the game in co-ops. At the end of the day, I think that's the worst thing about cheating in competitive games. It breaks the spirit of the game, and it makes it pointless even to play. It breaks the social contract of the game. I was surprised that Roll for the Galaxy and Dark Moon, both of which have you rolling dice behind a screen, have verbiage in the rules about not secretly changing the results. It is such a shame that they even have to say that. I must say, actually, though, I think it works quite well because, you know, we're all humans, and there is that sort of nudge thing that you that is very effective in either marketing or other fields, that, you know, if you just, you know, expose what they're likely to do, they're probably less likely to do it.
Yeah. Well, this is a class of games that always gives me a little bit of pause, even though I trust the people I game with and I trust myself. Is any game where you are getting a random result behind a screen that they're then assigning and then revealing. It's like, it's so easy to just kind of fudge those dice any which way, and nobody's checking you. It's like all trust-based, and you have to trust everyone you're playing with, plus trust to yourself at the same time. These ones are tricky.
Tricky.
He also mentions that 27 is not a prime number. Yeah.
We got several of those telling you this. 27 is not a prime number.
It is not.
We were tired, or we would have noticed and called him on it, I promise.
Yeah. Christopher is another one who mentioned it. He's like, I wanted to share a little anecdote about cheating in a situation I don't think you covered. Also wanted to remind Chris that 27 is not a prime number. I'm just not going to do math anymore. And by math, I mean just use numbers.
Say numbers, yeah.
Say numbers. So he says, and this relates back to the whole fudging behind the screen thing. He says, I went to learn Blood Rage at a local gaming store. I'd heard a lot about it and wanted to check it out. Early in the game, he noticed that the guy next to him moved his token on the score track and gave himself one extra point more than he had just earned. He didn't say anything. You know, he just figured he made a math error or something. As it turns out, later in the game, he noticed him do the exact same thing again, adding an extra point when he shouldn't have. So to me, well, to him, that confirmed that he was cheating. But again, he didn't want to make an issue of it because he didn't care as much about winning the game versus playing the game. He didn't end up winning, but it made me wonder, why cheat in a scenario like that? Is winning that important to you? Or was it more about looking like a bad player to the other group of strategists?
I don't know. It's a tricky one. You know, there's something about it when you're in a strange situation. You don't want to look bad, but at the same time, don't you look worse if you're caught doing it? Especially in a game like Blood Rage, where everyone can see what you're supposed to be scoring, how many points that would give you. Like somebody's going to catch you at this, like Christopher did. And like, where's the benefit?
So what do you think, Josh?
Well, I mean, I think well played to Christopher for not pointing it out. I mean, he could have called him out and that would have been totally fair, but it would have been awkward and excruciating. I'm just imagining that situation if you did. And I don't know, maybe this is just the polite Britishness in me coming out, but I think that was a very diplomatic thing to do for everyone at the table. So well played to Christopher there.
See, I think that this kind of goes back to what we were talking about in this episode, where you kind of get away with something a little bit. And then you find that that's your new line. So maybe this guy was thinking, it's like, well, I'm going to add a point each time that I move my thing. And that's going to, I'm just going to see if I can get away with it. If someone calls me on it, I can play dumb. But otherwise, let's just see if I can get away with it. And once he's okay with doing that, he could be doing that everywhere, right? Any game he plays, it's like, you know, there's a point track. So I'm just always going to give myself an extra point unless someone's paying attention. And if they're not paying attention, well, that's their bad, not mine.
I think, though, that there's a whole class of games that plays into this kind of thing. And if you're interested in that kind of gameplay, you should be playing something like Sheriff of Nottingham or BS or whatever bluffing game that there is out there where that's the whole point of the game and you're not breaking the game with this kind of behavior.
Yeah. I definitely don't think this is a good behavior. And we don't know if this person was maybe honestly making a math mistake. Or maybe Christopher is his first time playing. Maybe he didn't realize there was another point coming from someplace else on the board. So we don't know that this was the case, but let's assume that it is for the sake of argument. And in this particular case, I would probably, if I was the experienced player at the table and noticed, I would probably call them out on it. If I was the inexperienced player, I'd be like, wait, so you got 5 points for that. Where did you get the other point? Just so I'm clear on the rules, you know, kind of play it out in like a passive aggressive way. Cause I'm a very passive aggressive.
Oh, I love passive aggressive.
It's my MO. All right, let's move on to managing your collection, which we had so many people say so many things about. We start out with Jesse on throwing away boxes and the story in the so basically talking about storing things in compact solutions, like, you know, throw away your boxes and you can put it all in little baggies and all that kind of stuff. He's like, I'm with Chris on this. I feel so lost if I have to throw away boxes. The box is essentially a piece of art and should be displayed properly on your game shelf. And Kitty, apparently you created a hashtag in this episode.
Shelf candy.
Yeah, so we're gonna have to just own this. Hashtag shelf candy, which makes so much sense because that is a lot of what our board games are today.
I want some tweets. Tweet me your shelf candy. I'm at Lawful Good Mom.
All right. We're going to make this a thing. Okay. Now, lots of people talked about tracking plays and stuff. Josh, why don't you kick us off on this one?
They did. And I think Kitty made a friend here because Robert says, Kitty, you mentioned wanting to start a spreadsheet to track your gameplays. Did we just become best friends? I too nerd out over spreadsheets and for the past several years have been logging my plays in a simple one with the date, the name of the game played, and the winner. I've also included a matrix with the names of the games I own and the number of times each was played in any given year. There is a conditional formatting applied to the cells containing the titles. If the game hasn't been played in over a year, it highlights in yellow. If it hasn't been played in over 2 years, it highlights in red. At a quick glance, this gives me a lot of information on the games in my collection that, for one reason or another, haven't gotten any recent attention. Yellow highlighted games get me thinking about titles I haven't played in a while red highlighted games become trade fodder or go up for sale unless I have a compelling reason to keep them.
Since recording this episode, I have started a spreadsheet for my Kickstarter games,
woo-woo,
which is beautiful. And I'm going to have to figure out how to do this conditional formatting because I want to start getting the, if I haven't received my game within its promised timeline, it'll highlight in red. I love it. I love it so much.
I think spreadsheets. Robert said to send us, you're using a Google Doc, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So I think this may sound like overkill to a lot of people. I like how it starts out, a simple spreadsheet, and then we go down to conditional formatting.
I love it.
Exactly what I was thinking.
However, I'm going to defend Robert here and say there are so many ways to enjoy your gaming collection, even while you're not playing games. Like, I'll spend hours sleeving cards or reorganizing things or, like, just there's painting, putting together miniatures. Like, there's so many ways to enjoy it. This is just another way to enjoy your game collection while you're not playing it, and more power to you. I love this. All right. Michael says, Kitty, there are wonderful apps for tracking your plays already. So we were talking about maybe creating an app for tracking our board game plays. He's like, I don't know of one of those that has a barcode scanner. So if Chris, me, does make that a feature, then I'm willing to pay $5 for it. Maybe I will. But if you're okay with just typing the game name in and doing a little pre-setup like entering your regular play group and friends, then there are a couple apps that are already there. So he says ScorePal for Android is a really good one. And on his iPhone, he's using BG Stat, which is also pretty good. They both sync up to BGG. So if you happen to change your apps, it'll transfer over your stuff there. He says, I'm on board with the fact that BGG is also in desperate need of an overhaul. Mobile is unusable, like you said, and the desktop version is clunky and dated.
I like that this app syncs with BGG so that I don't have to use BGG because it's awful.
You may still have to go and add your game collection, but that actually isn't too hard once you find it. Finding it will require several Google searches.
Oh, boy.
Jerry also mentioned different email, but same related, that Board Game Bible is a good app for managing your collection, which I believe is available on iOS. So if you're looking for an app.
I love just crowdsourcing out the, what should I use, to our listeners. I always get so much good information back from them.
I know. It's really tempting. Like the BGG API, that's Application Programmer Interface for those who don't speak nerd. It's really how a computer talks to BGG to get all of your information from, is a pretty decent one. And I could actually work with it pretty well if I get motivated. But first I need to have a baby, then go on paternity leave. People laugh at me when I say maternity. I can be maternal. I can be a boy and maternal.
All right.
Yeah. So anyway, let's go talk about buying some used games.
This one sparked quite a bit of feedback. So Christopher says there are a couple of reasons that he may buy used games. If it is a game that I'm not sure that I will like or is out of print, or a theme or IP that doesn't really speak to me, I find that buying used games is an excellent way of exploring mechanisms that I am unsure about. I will also buy used games when I feel like I won't use it enough to justify the new price. For example, I would love to buy TI4, but the chances that I'll get it to the table are low enough that I don't feel like I can justify the cost. But if I could buy a complete used copy for a decent price, I would.
Ooh, this speaks to my frugal nature, you see. I really warm to this idea. And I guess sort of everyone has their price for any particular given game. And, you know, TI4, we're already on TI4. I thought it was only TI3. That's blowing my mind already. For instance, if Chris was buying a game and it happened to be Cards Against Humanity, I'm pretty sure you would pay people not to play that game.
Yes, I will. If you want to play Cards Against Humanity with me, I'll just give you $20 and we will go have a frosty beverage. We'll have the same amount of fun. But this does resonate with me a little bit too. I like the idea of buying used games that you don't want to spend a lot of money on to see if you like. And at one point in my life, in the last couple years, there should have been a lot of times where I just would go and buy used games, check it out, and then immediately turn around and sell them again. Now, though, I'm trying to not buy games. So I figure if I don't think I'm going to like it enough to pay full price, then I'm probably going to pass on it anyway. But I don't know that that's a good thing either. And there's another comment coming up that I'll add to it more then.
Huh, interesting. I think that is a good thing, but we'll see, Chris. We'll see. From Tim regarding buying used games. I definitely look to buy games used. About 2/3 of my games were purchased used. eBay is really worth worthwhile after factoring the shipping prices, but I've had a lot of luck purchasing locally by consistently scouring Craigslist, OfferUp, and Letgo. Okay, I think he was saying eBay isn't really worth it.
Yeah, eBay is rarely worth it. So eBay does get a bad rap with games. I do find, though, that if I want rare stuff, eBay is usually the place to go. If I'm looking for like promos or something like that, that tends to be where I want to go. I like this idea. I've never used Craigslist. It reminds me of Reddit. That style of interface, I can't handle it. But OfferUp and Letgo are really interesting apps for this. We used Letgo a lot when we were moving our last move and we just wanted to get rid of stuff. And we'd put something up on Letgo and then 20 minutes later, someone would come and pick it up. And I think that's kind of a really neat idea and an interesting way of trading games and stuff.
All right. Christopher Anderson gives us a list of places to buy a used game. Your local game store will often have a section. And contrary to Josh's comment, many conventions have flea markets to buy and sell games from. Some conventions, like Gen Con, have a consignment sale as well.
Well, that's great news. I'm glad to hear it. And I must also admit, much like Kitty did earlier, that I've completely forgotten what comment I made those weeks ago. But that's, you know, that's great. I think it's, you know, any opportunity to buy games at a discount rate. Like I said, I'm super frugal. I'm all about this. Yes.
Yeah. Next time we go to a convention together, I will take you to the different flea markets that exists. So most conventions will have something like this. I didn't know that Gen Con had a consignment sale. So consignment is essentially you just give it a price, you put it on a table, and they'll sell it for you. But with the flea market, you're basically bringing a stack of games, you buy a little table, you have a certain amount of time, and people come, and you can sell your games off that way. So the bigger conventions typically have this, and a lot of smaller conventions will have this as well. All right, this is the comment that I was talking about. Set me up, Josh.
Oh, Terry comments on Kickstarter and buying games. I will no longer buy a Kickstarter game that doesn't have exclusive, period. Think about it. Buying it on Kickstarter simply costs more than buying it when it comes out. Stores like Cool Stuff Inc., Miniature Market, and even Amazon sells game at discounted prices even when they are brand new.
So Kitty and I have an addiction, and we're proud of it in some ways. I don't disagree with Terry here, though. So there are times, and we try to do one game a week, and that's sad that that's, you know, restricting ourselves, but
limiting it, right?
But we try not to do more than one game a week, and oftentimes the deciding factor will be, is this game going to come out in retail? Now, Kickstarter has a lot of games that will not come out in retail. Like, if you don't get them in Kickstarter, you're never going to see them. So to me, the whole game is exclusive. But yeah, I will say the Kickstarter exclusives do sell the game for me for that exact reason, where I'm going to spend an extra anywhere from $5 to $20 on shipping. Plus, I'm playing full retail price usually. So they have to offer me something to make me pull that trigger. And it can't just be a pretty game.
So my thoughts on this are that when you are kickstarting a game, you are not buying the game. You are supporting the designer. You are saying that I am going to back this because I want to see this game made. And a lot of these games, this is the only way they can get it made. These are indie publishers. These are things that are not going to be made any other way. So I am not buying a game. I am supporting an industry with my patronage. And if you think of it that way, I think it's a little bit better, which is why CMON drives me nuts, because they don't need to do this and they're just selling exclusives. They are just creating hype and buzz, and it makes me crazy.
So for CMON, it's more of a pre-order thing, and they do give you a ton in exchange for your pre-order. So I'll give you that. But
yeah, it's just pre-orders.
Yeah. But CMON is actually moving further and further away from the Kickstarter model. They're doing it a little bit because they know it's good marketing. They know they're going to make, you know, $1 million when they do this. And it does help with the production runs. But they are in a situation where they don't need it anymore. So, yeah, but you are right. I mean, I know if I listen to any of my Kickstarter episodes supporting the designers, I think I'm just going through a whole, do I really need all these games phase right now? And maybe.
I don't know. I think they're just creating all this ridiculous hype, and they have to hype things up more and more every time with their 2-foot Cthulhu and their mini Kickstarters now, where it's a quick 1 week. It all just seems like stunts to me. Right. And so, yeah, those ones, go ahead, buy it on Cool Stuff Inc. They're going to make their money anyway, but I'm going to, you know, spend the extra $10 to, you know, make sure the designer is getting paid full price for the game.
All right. Well, I'm going to come over with a fully painted copy of something, which will never happen, and make you play it. And you're going to be like, wow, this is a CMON game. This is actually pretty good. But we'll get there eventually.
They're not bad games.
They are. But I understand your point completely. I do.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Speaking of, let's go to the opposite of getting games and go to getting rid of games. Grant wrote us in about his local store's biannual game auction. He says, I've gotten some really good prices on games, so this is kind of a little bit of a both, but I was interested in, and also got rid of games that weren't being played. You bring in your games a couple of weeks or prior to the auction, then they have a 2-day auction over a weekend. On the day of the auction, or if not a little sooner, you get a list of all the games being offered. You can go in early to take a look at the games you might be interested in. Selling that many games is a long process, so you can take a book with you. Or they actually have tables where you can play games while they're auctioning games, which I just think is hilarious. He says you can take a break when it's your turn, or when a game that you're interested in comes up, you go over and you bid on it, then you come back. And the money, so the way they do this to support, you know, running the auction is all of the money used to buy games goes to store credits for the people who are selling the games. So he's like, the store doesn't offer a ton of discounts, but when you're spending store credit, he doesn't mind spending all of its credit there. So I think it's kind of a neat idea.
Store credit will get you every time. That's how Target keeps pulling me in.
It's like, it's not even real money.
Yeah. Oh, if I go buy all this stuff at Target, they're going to give me gift cards. Yeah, of course I'm going to go do that. Tricky.
Josh, do you do the auction thing? Is this something that you would like try to get a good deal at, like sitting at an auction?
I mean, I know he kind of explains it in the thing, but I'm still like, how is the store making money? I guess if it's all store credit, you're putting that back into the store, but it's still a bit like, so it's the people's own personal games that they're auctioning up. And then everyone just gets store credit and then spends it at the game store?
Yes.
Is that how it works?
So imagine this. So I bring in my Arcadia Quest because I have 3 copies. And I put it up there and I put it up there for $50. And it sells for $65. Well, the store is collecting your $65, but they aren't giving me $65. They're giving me $65 in credit. The store is marking everything up anywhere from, you know, 25 to 50%. So they're actually collecting $30-some off of that sale because they're giving me their wholesale price type of idea. Does that make more sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That clears it up a bit. Yeah.
So cool. I don't know. I like this idea. I would do this. I would absolutely put my games up and be part of like a weekend long event for this.
Also, they're pulling in people like Chris, who are going to walk into the game store thinking, oh, I'm going to bid on one game. And he's going to bid on one game, and he's going to buy that one game, and then he's going to buy the 3 other games that they're selling on their shelves because he's in the door.
Yeah, especially if there's expansions. And
they're new. He saw them. Yeah.
I got to get those.
All right. So Eric had some suggestions for getting rid of games. The best way is to do a math trade at a convention. Basically, you say, here's a list of games I want to trade for games other people have put on the list. The magic comes in the program that matches everyone up so that you give someone a copy of Catan and somebody else gives you a copy of Ticket to Ride or one of the games that you wanted in trade for Catan. He also suggested bulk sales to local game stores or local setting apps and websites.
Yeah, so kind of like the ones we just talked about, Letgo and those types of things.
Yeah.
So this is the best way I've ever heard the math trade described. And I guess I always knew it worked this way. But now I'm starting to think it's like, oh, this could be really interesting because it is driven by software. You just put all the stuff that you want up there. And, you know, you could, it's kind of like 6 degrees of separation. Like, I'm not trading with one other person. I'm trading with a group of people. And as long as everyone gets what they want, you walk away happy. And I kind of like this.
This is how the kidney matching works.
I was gonna say that same thing.
Oh no, I'm sorry. But yeah, it's basically the same thing because you might not be a blood match for someone who needs, you know, your family member who needs a kidney. So the algorithm puts everyone together and, you know, you all get matched up to people who you match with and other people get matched to your family member. Yeah, it seems to be good.
Do you think the kidney algorithm came from the board game algorithm?
Probably not.
I'm sure it did. You have to be careful, though, because I think it was an episode of Grey's Anatomy or House or something where there was the one person whose mistress was donating the kidney, but they were pretending like she wasn't his mistress. And everyone was like, oh, you're just such a good person. And then the whole thing fell apart. So one person, you know, is lying about their ticket to ride. The whole trade is just going to dissolve.
Yeah, I'm going to bet that that's Grey's Anatomy. And I'm also going to say I wouldn't take too many life lessons from it.
You're just ruining my whole life philosophy, Chris.
I just found out the other day that that show is still on the air and it's like 15 seasons.
Yeah.
I stopped watching it
like season 10.
The funny thing is that's exactly Gloria's philosophy in life as well. It's like she'll watch something on TV and she'll just be like enamored with the idea that this is going to happen in real life. And I'm like, no, you just saw something on TV. This isn't actually going to happen. She's like, it could happen.
No, it probably can't. All right. Well, this was one of our most popular episodes. One of the questions that I asked in this episode was whether or not people would be interested if I put my games up and like had price lists. And there's over 20 emails of people saying, yes, I'd be interested. So I think I'm going to do that. I'm going to put my games up and see. Now, I might end up doing this as part of the Jack Vassell Memorial charity auction. I need to double check when that is. I think it's in January every year. And the way that auction works is it's running on a thread on BGG. You put up the game, you put up a price, people bid for it, and then all of the money on the bids go to the charity. So I can both get rid of my games and everything goes to charity as well. And it's sort of as a nice mix there. So I did not expect this episode to be... There was just so much feedback. Thank you, everybody. And we haven't mentioned it yet, but when we get to the end of the episode, we will be drawing our winners for feedback and input in patrons. So stay tuned. It's coming soon. Okay, complicated games. This was our last week's episode. And let's start this off with Christopher Miller, who mentioned that one kind of complexity we did not mention is physical complexity. So we mentioned... I need to pull up the notes because I should have had this. But there was four different categories of complexity, like how hard it is to learn, what's the strategy, a couple other things. But I think physical complexity is an interesting one as well. Now, I don't know if this means like dexterity-wise, like it's, you know, flick them up, it's tricky to flick over the cowboys, or if this is just a sheer number of components you need to manage, even though the game itself might be simple. I think both of those could apply here.
I read it as the components being complex, and I think maybe it didn't occur to us because we put this in its own episode of Fiddly Bits or something like that, where we talked all about how crazy managing your pieces can be in some of these games, like where you breathe on the board and it's like, oh no,
the game is ruined. Over. Everything's been ruined.
The cat wrecked it.
I mean, I also had the same thing Chris did. I was like, wait, does he mean Twister or Can Jam or any of these other like sporty games that you do, yard games that you do outside? But no, I think you're right. I think it's fiddly bits, basically.
And I'm going to say, because I'm looking for our show notes now, I may have inadvertently erased episode 111's show notes.
Ooh, and that's crazy.
Wrote over with this episode's show notes. We may never know. That episode was so complex that the show notes decided to disappear.
The universe ate it.
The great lost episode. Oh, wow.
The lost episode notes anyway.
Anyway, Michael says he's helping us out on definitions. He says opposite of complicated is simple, not easy. Chess is the ultimate example. It's a simple game, but it's not easy. It also isn't about just protecting your pieces as you make the next move. Curse you, Josh and Chris.
Well, in my defense, I don't protect my pieces when I make moves. And I don't actually take out other people's pieces too. Chess is really, really hard, and I don't like it because it makes my brain hurt.
What? You like Homeworlds? It's basically the same thing.
That's crazy. Like Homeworlds. I like Homeworlds a lot more because I think Homeworlds is far easier. Is that the term we're going to use? No, simpler.
More simple.
Yeah. So more simple, simpler, whatever grammar you want to use. Homeworlds is a simpler version of a full information strategic game, such as chess would be. And I just can wrap my head around those strategies a little bit better. Even though it seems more abstract, there's only four different types of moves versus all the different chess pieces that you have.
That's it's true. Streamlined.
Yes. And I mean, there's some really, really interesting things that can happen. Again, I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but we will talk about depth in a few minutes. But this is actually, no, we'll talk about it right now. Josh, why don't you just keep reading? We'll get there.
Exactly. Michael continues. Opposite of easy is hard. A hard game need not be complicated. Again, chess is a prime example. And many complicated games are not hard to play or hard to win. TI4 is probably one of the most complicated games out there due to the number of rules for what it actually does. But there are many simpler games that are harder, but not more complicated.
I see where he's going, and I think, you know, it's a problem of definitions. We were talking more complicated strategy-wise, whereas, you know, complicated or hard, I don't know.
Well, and I think that's interesting because I was usually talking more complicated learning and rules maintenance wise. And I think that that's what he's kind of pointing out here too, is complicated is so different for everybody. Like, what is a complicated game? It sort of depends on where your head goes. You know, Josh, you feel chess is very complicated, but I mentioned it wasn't complicated because it's easy to learn. So it's, right. Yeah.
Well, anyway, there's more. He says, but here's the big one. Deep does not equal complicated and vice versa. Depth is what keeps us coming back to try new strategies, approaches. Depth is what makes a game with simple rules, like chess, the subject of literal centuries of study. Depth, in my opinion, is what game designers should be striving for, with complexity sometimes being the necessary evil in that pursuit.
Now, that's interesting because I think we already covered the fact that, you know, we were saying that myself and Kitty were kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum because I liked these sort of what he's calling a deep game, you know, like chess. And I like that kind of strategy. Whereas Kitty kind of likes those heavy Euro games where there's like maybe what he's calling complicated rule sets, but you know, there's lots of moving pieces. There's lots to think about. And that seems to throw me for a loop. Whereas Kitty seems to pick those up very quickly and easily compared to me.
I only dog pedal. I like the shallow games. I like to hang out where it's cool and easy.
I don't,
but nice. Yeah, but they don't seem easy to me, those games. Like, that's the thing. It's so weird. Like, that kind of game is easy to you, but for me, it's really not. I'm like, I'm confused instantly. I'm like, what's going on?
It's this Castles of Burgundy versus Photosynthesis thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like, Josh, you loved Photosynthesis. And Kitty, you loved Castles of Burgundy. Both of them are puzzly. Like, they both have this interesting figure it out how to optimize move. It's just, I think some games are more mathematically streamlined, so there seems like there's a mathematical solution to it, and others are more, I don't want to say organic, but it's more of a gut feeling in those other ones, where it's like you can follow your strategy, and as long as you keep following that strategy, you're probably going to be okay. You don't need to make sure it's mathematically correct. Or maybe I'm just making stuff up.
I buy it.
All right. So Christopher seems to think that he knows us. So he's going to sum up our gaming preferences. Let's see how well he does compared to Josh and what I just did. He says, I think a big strength of your podcast is that each of the hosts has a different set of preferences of what kind of games they like. Chris seems to gravitate towards more adventure type quest games. Josh is all about highly interactive, more party style games. And Kitty, like me, or like Christopher, which is not me, prefers more strategic
different or Christopher.
Puzzly, yeah, different. Prefers more strategic or puzzly games, including Euros. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would say he's pretty spot on. I mean, you know, like he says, I like those interactive party type games and, you know, things like yard games and stuff. Love that stuff. It's so cool and easy and like social.
I would say, though, that he kind of missed out on the dual aspect of Josh's game enjoyment, because you are either like super shallow party games or like super deep strategy games, and there's nothing in the middle for you. Yeah. It's either the like completely abstract, I can see everything, I can think 10 moves ahead, or it's the my brain is off and I am doing like a fun thing. Yeah. Like, there's nothing in between there, and I hope that's not insulting.
No, no, not at all. No, that's totally right, and I'm proud of it.
It's not slander if it's true.
All right, so Melissa sent us some feedback regarding Arkham Horror. Chris, now you know how I feel when you talk about Terraforming Mars. I love Terraforming Mars, and I have a similar reaction to yours every time it comes up on the podcast. I will try to give Arkham Horror another shot to see if I can get into it. I make no promises.
So I believe this is Melissa referring to the fact that I felt that Arkham Horror can seem like a complicated game. Kitty borrowed the box from me, looked at two instruction books, looked at the... You didn't even get to the cards themselves, I don't think. And she's like, no, this is too complicated.
Done.
And I'm like, yes, but once you get into it, it's the most amazing game ever. So I think that's what Melissa's saying is you need to play Terraforming Mars more than four times in order to really get into it, because darn it, the puppy strategy isn't always the best strategy. Although it's the only one I've ever seen win.
All right, so she continues, heading in another direction, I was thinking about your discussion of single versus multiple objectives. I agree it can be frustrating to decide which direction to go in when there are multiple objectives. Sometimes I have to force myself to find a strategy and stick with it, because it's easy to want to try to complete all the objectives. I find what makes a bigger difference is if there is a set number of turns or rounds, or a variable number. I think that a set number of rounds, such as in Castles of Burgundy, aids me in planning ahead because I know how much time I have to work through my strategy. It's not a surprise that the game is ending, so it makes it easier for me to manage my expectations.
Yeah, I would largely agree with that. I think that the tricky part comes in with some games, like for instance, Blood Rage, you get to draft cards. And I do really like Blood Rage as a game. But the problem with drafting, adding that element in, is that you can be like, okay, so round one, I'm getting a lot of these cards, so I'll just go for that strategy. And then maybe round two or three, you just get none of that cards, any cards that work well with the first strategy you went with. And you're like, oh, if I'd gone with the other strategy, I would have had such a brilliant card setup and a brilliant engine right now. And so that's what pulls me in different directions sometimes. But also it is the analysis paralysis too. I've got to admit it a little bit.
I definitely see that. I think I also agree with Melissa here that I like it when there's a set number of rounds or something like that where I know when the end is coming. Because a lot of times I'll play with one group of people and I'll think like, oh, I've got a handle on this game. I've got this. And then I play with Sydney and it ends in half the time because she always goes for the race strategy. It always seems to be she's the one who's going to race to the end of the game. I'm going to buy all the cards that end the game. I'm going to buy all the teepees. Every time I play with her, I'm like, ah, it's over. And I didn't see it coming.
So I think you had pointed this out in this episode where, a complex game can be one that has multiple objectives versus only one objective. And having multiple objectives does make things more complicated. And this resonated with a lot of different people that was... it is true. The more things you can do in a game, the more complicated the game becomes. And especially when you can't do all of them. Because there are some games where it's like, oh, you can do this, 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 and this. And by the end of the game, you are going to be maxed out on all of them. It doesn't really matter what the order. Blood Rage is a decent example of that. Typically, you have three different tracks. Typically, you're probably going to have most of those tracks pretty high up by the end of the game. So you don't necessarily need to focus in one over the other, although you should always focus in Rage at the beginning so you have more actions later on. But like, it can be complicated, far more complicated when you have to make those early decisions, especially when you're new to the game as well. So, all right, let's see. We're going to end this with Trevor, some sage words from Trevor. Now, Trevor's one of my favorite... He texts me in the morning on coffee. He texts me in the evening on whatever he happens to be drinking at the time. And he has some of the best emails ever. They're very, very long. Trevor, I read them all. And this one, I took a snippet out of it. I really love what he did here. So what this discussion left me with is that complexity is a thing. But in and of itself, it's not a good or bad thing. It is an ingredient the outcome can be positively affected by rightly using it in the proper quantity. Or conversely, complexity can be the one ingredient that ruins whatever it is you're making, reading, playing. Sometimes even, it gets blamed when the other ingredients are actually off. But then, that comes back around to complexity being harder to find. I give up. This subject's too complex.
Oh, wow. That is super deep and philosophical. I love it, Trevor. I don't know. I feel like he was sort of talking about life there. No, but it's true. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like almost when he's talking about it as an ingredient, it's kind of like that. Oh, where is the right exact amount? Like, you know, you keep putting a little bit more salt in. Oh, it's tasting better, better, better. And then there's just a point where if you just put a little bit more, it's like, oh, it's way too salty. So, yeah, I think this definitely resonates with me.
And you got the word salty in there. I like it.
Yeah, I think this is really true, that complexity is not good and bad in and of itself. It merely is a part of the game, a very hard to define part of the game.
Yep. Apparently, there's lots of ways of looking at it. So one more bonus here. Terrence, who does all of our tagging of our games on BGG, he does our proof listening. He listens to each episode twice. I really should just add him to the payroll if we had a payroll. And Terrence, we don't thank you enough, but we truly appreciate everything you do. We had joked that we were saying complicated a lot in the last episode. So he says, since you asked, I thought I would find the following, you would find the following tally of words said in the most recent episode interesting. So Terrence, I don't know how you did this. I'm just assuming you sat down and just started making tick marks. He says we used the word complicated 71 and a half times, because I just got to con in one and then I moved on. He says we used the word complexity 31 times, complex 22 times, complication 8 times, and complexified was used just once.
I bet it was Chris.
It probably was me. She's like, he finally hands, I like what Kitty said about how there are games that feel complicated while learning or teaching, but simple as you play. For me, that is Firefly, the game. You have 4 possible actions, buy, fly, work, or deal. Learning how to take those actions takes a bit more time, but once you have it, it's pretty simple. So that was our complicated cheating games collection management episode.
Almost.
Managing your collection of cheating games?
We're probably just going to call it cheating collections. It's complicated. All right. We do have a couple winners. These are $50 gift certificates to most likely Amazon. Everyone usually picks Amazon. But if you want to do Cool Stuff, Inc., I can do that too. The only caveat is you have to participate in either sending us email and feedback or participate in the BGG forums or be a patron. And we split it up into two. So we have the feedback is one group of people, and then the patrons and the BGG participants are another group of people. We then randomly pick somebody from those lists, and you then have to tell me, hey, I heard my name. Also, sorry, Ashton. Ashton told me he heard his name a long, long time ago, and I completely forgot to send him his winning gift. So if you are out there and you didn't get something that you think you should have, email me. I promise I'm not trying to promise things and then never deliver. So for the next two people who get to tell me that they won and then wait for a week and a half before I finally get around to sending out the gift cards from our feedback, that will be Grant Lovett. You are a $50 winner. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Hooray.
And for our BGG and patron participation, Josh, you say this name.
Oh, goodness. I wasn't looking at it. Oh, Tim Bushell.
Bushell?
That's what I'm going for. I might be wrong.
I can go with that.
I was going to say Bushell.
Bushell?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right.
Well, if your name is Tim and your last name can be murdered in a similar way to what we've just said, send us an email. That is at, I should probably have that just be, I'm not going to make it up a new email address for everything, but just feedback at tabletopgametalk.com is fine. Let's see. Oh, we are going to have 2 more episodes. Oh boy, I'm trying to think when I'm going to be in Essen. We are going to not miss any weeks, although we may have an episode of just Sydney and I, and I think there might be a Kickstarter episode that we may skip, depending. So unless Sydney and I do one, maybe I can get her to.
I'll just do one by myself.
If you and Josh want to do
one in the office,
yeah,
all right, we could do it.
Yeah.
You guys have. I've never not been on an episode on this channel.
Now we have to do it, Josh.
I know. We've got to stick it to him and talk smack about him when he's not around.
All right, we're setting it up. We'll make it happen. So that'll be in about 2.5 weeks. So the 20th, I'm leaving to France on the 20th, and then Essen is the 25th, 6th, 7th, 8th, sometime around there. So if you're in Germany and you want to say hi, let me know. I will be just overwhelmed by everything. So that's really what that episode will be, is Sydney and I just saying, this is what Essen is, and this is our overwhelmingness of it. It won't be like a live show or anything like that. It'll literally just be kind of our take on this mega show, the world's biggest board game convention. Then we will be in GameholeCon, although Josh has found out he has a work conflict. Is that still the case?
No, I'm so sorry. Yeah, it is. I'm being sent to a medical conference, which I'm going to sunny Bel Air, which is a little bit of a silver lining, but it means I miss it.
That's all right. That's fine. I got Sydney, your press badge for you.
Spencer signed up, and I was like, oh, why don't you like pick a couple games to go play? You're really into RPGs. This is a big RPG convention. And he signed up for so much stuff that I don't know if I'm going to see him all weekend.
That's awesome, though. Like, he should really...
He's so into it.
Yeah.
He's very excited.
Yep. And we'll probably play True Dungeon, too, while we're there, because True Dungeon is at GameholeCon, which is one of the few conventions that's at. It's basically Gen Con Origins and GameholeCon. So that one will be, that should be fun. And we will do an episode from GameholeCon. It'll probably be just a normal episode. We'll just record it there. And so we'll have a little bit of a ambiance in the background, but it won't be like a live episode or anything like that. Live episodes are kind of hit or miss for people. They like the topic stuff, but you know, for the live episode it's a little trickier if you're not there. I think that's it. Oh, I got banners made up for it and everything. So we have like big things for our booth.
So excited.
Yeah. I just got them in the other day. They look really, really cool. And I'm just going to post like a picture of Sydney over Josh's face. It's going to be awesome.
Fair play.
All right. If you want to follow us, you can follow us on Facebook. We're at @TabletopGameTalkPodcast. We have 200 likes now. So if that gets up to 250 likes, I promise to be active on it at least once a week, and that doesn't mean my auto post from the blog. That is my challenge. I'm at Twitter. No, actually, the whole podcast is at Twitter at TabletopGameTLK. Kitty is Lawful Good Mom. Josh is Josh's Blonde. And I'm at Game Master Chris. You can also leave us reviews on iTunes, because we always love that. And you can help us out on Patreon at TabletopGameTalkPodcast.com/Patreon, or you can go to Patreon and search for Tabletop Game Talk. That helps us do all our giveaways and keep the lights on as far as server fees and all of that kind of stuff. Kitty.
All right. Tabletop Game Talk is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. Thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So email us with comments or questions about today's topic at feedback@tabletopgametalk.com. And you'll be entered into a $50 gift card drawing on our next feedback episode.
Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons, Emil Jiljam, George, Adam Harrison, Corey Bell, the SGC,
Samir Biswas, Jason Strong, Terrence Miltner, Stephen Seitz, Michael Ohl, Brian Arnold, Sean P. Kelly, C. Marie, Rudy Liu,
Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Wong, Stefan, I've already used the Josh's brother thing, Phillips, Caleb O'Brien, Jennifer O'Brien, Justin Willard, Christopher Dogg,
Jason Marks, Jeremy Fisher, Carl Hammond, David Radke, Lance Morgan, Nick Quickstra, David Sellers, Jason Rodney, Michael Yanikowski, Miles Clark,
Cindy Lum, Phil Schwartzel, Jordan Livingston, Chad Covey, Ann Reynolds, Eric Hoffman, Adrian Dong,
Christopher Vincent, Nate Fasfunthum, Sean Peck, Eric Slander, Mike Smith, Christine Meyer, Trevor Davis, Wesley Trailer, Tim Vernig, Chris Lowe, Joe Hoover, and Timothy Gross.
Until next week, keep playing games and having fun.
Oh, we're meant to talk now? Oh, he's doing this thing again.
You're pointing at a screen. It doesn't work that way. I can't even see your finger. This is what a finger point looks like.
Nobody was supposed to know we were doing this remote. This was all like stealthy. You've ruined everything.
Yeah, so you ruined it with your pointing.